Welcome to the Evo India podcast. Now, generally, December is a time when we are all on a break, making plans for going on holidays, digging into cakes, putting on weight. But there is a crazy set of people, guys like Ashish Rao Rane, who we are speaking to today, for whom December is the culmination of everything that they've been working on through the year. All the training, all the testing, all the hard work, all the sponsor influencing, all of that culminates in December when they get ready for the mother of all motorsport events, the hardcore of the hardcore rallies, the Dakar, which kicks off in January in Saudi Arabia. Ashish, thank you for being on the Evo India podcast. Excited? Looking forward to the Dakar?
Yes, definitely. Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here and talking to you. 100% looking forward to it. Excited, yes, of course, but there's still with 3 weeks to go, there's still so much to do.
So much to do as in now what's left? Obviously, you've sorted out your bike, you've sorted out your sponsors, you're looking fit. So now what's left?
Just the last minute admin stuff, you know, visas and booking your flights. I still have one final training session remaining in Dubai, getting the logistics in place for that, bike rental. So there's all the gear to put together, you know, things are coming together, but there's still a lot to do. It's small things, but they all add up.
So in this podcast, we're going to talk about what it takes to get yourself up to a certain skill level to actually take part in the Dakar, to qualify for the Dakar.
Yes.
What do you need in terms of sponsors, in terms of money, in terms of training? What all do you need to do? Your life journey, getting up all the way till here. This is not your first Dakar, not your first rodeo. So what has it taken to get to where you are? And obviously, what your goals are for the Dakar 2024. Now, let's start with why the Dakar. Obviously, Dakar has got this entire romance associated with it. It's got history, everything. But to you personally, why put in so much? And you know, it takes an incredible amount of work just to get to the Dakar start line. Forget getting to the finish. Why put yourself through it?
I think Dakar as a rally in general differentiates itself in the difficulty level. Of course, everybody talks about the difficulty level, and I had done quite a few rallies before I went to the Dakar. I even raced the Africa Eco Race, which runs from France down into Senegal. You know, having said that, the difficulty level of the Dakar is still so much higher, and the first time you go there, that is when you realize how tough it is. And what I realized on the first Dakar was that you're tested, you're pushed really to your limits, the way the course is designed and how difficult the course is. And in general, you know, we say this very casually, like, you know, never give up. But at the Dakar, for the 14 days you're racing, every day it's like handed to you on a plate, you know. This is, you want to test, never give up. This is your chance. And you think, okay, you know, maybe today was tough, tomorrow might be a little easy. But it's not. It's day after day, and you got to test yourself, push yourself to the limit every single day. And I think that eventually is what draws people back to it, because you really want to push yourself and test yourself.
You could also call it being suckers for punishment.
Yes, in a way. I think there's a certain kind of people the Dakar attracts, and people who want to basically live that adventure. But at the same time, it's not a tour. Yes, it's a race. But within that race, there's so much happening, and you have that chance of really knowing yourself. It's that tough.
When was your first competitive motorcycling event?
2015. Yes, that was 2015. That was the INRC, the National Rally Championship. That was a chance event, really.
How did that come about?
I went off-roading with a friend, and, you know, just a couple of days before I went out to sea. And when I came back, we were just looking to go off-roading a little bit. So we put together like a motley crew. It was in Nasik, so it's close very proximal, close by. You know, ease of getting there, ease of entry, ease of accessibility, basically, to do that race. And we went on big adventure motorcycles. We were on the Tiger 800s at the time, five of us.
Okay. So just for reference, Ashish is based out of Pune. So Pune Nasik is very close. And it's obviously the same set of motorcycling people also. So you would know the guys in Nasik. Yes. And you would have local support.
Yeah, it was just a weekend thing that, you know, four or five of us decided to do.
Hmm.
And I really liked the format. I liked the format of where it wasn't elbow to elbow racing, but you're racing against time. Mm. And that is what I still love about rallying.
Yeah. You're racing yourself.
Yes. And you're pushing yourself. And that is where I thought that, yeah, maybe I could do a few more of this. And then I started looking at, you know, Raid the Himalaya, mm. which was my next rally. And then the Desert Storm, and eventually, yeah, things escalated out of control.
Before you did the first INRC in Nasik, was adventure biking always in your blood?
Yes, I have extensively toured the country, starting with, you know, even Harley Davidsons at the time, mm-hmm. when those were the only motorcycles available in India.
Big motorcycles,
let's say, available in India, which would, you know, take you thousands of kilometers in relative comfort. As soon as Triumph made their entry, I wanted something which was more off-road focused, or, you know, could essentially handle the bad roads.
Mm.
And I took that even, you know, down to the border of Arunachal with China. So I toured extensively before I started racing. And then I raced on the same motorcycle. And eventually I upgraded to an enduro motorcycle, and then, well.
So what prompted you, or what gave you the leeway to make the jump from Indian rallying to go to the Dakar, to go to foreign shores?
So I was always looking for the next bigger challenge. Once the INRC was done, it was the Raid de Himalaya. Mm. Once the raid was done, I wanted to go race the desert. But when I went to race the India Baja, that was the two-day desert race in Bikaner at the time, in its first edition, I found myself really out of depth. I didn't know how to handle that big motorcycle in sand.
Mm.
Eventually, 2 months later, I went back to Desert Storm on a smaller enduro motorcycle, still a really old beat-up Yamaha. And then I figured out that, okay, the motorcycle's like just part of the puzzle. I need to be fit. Mm. I need to up my skills. And then I went back the next year with a better motorcycle with, let's say, relatively better skills.
Mm.
And it was this year that I really started thinking of doing something international. And eventually I met Jordi Grau, who was there supporting Santosh at the time.
Yeah.
And we had a conversation on how I could get to Spain and start training, and what would be the pathway to going international. So that's how it really started.
Okay. What was your first international rally raid?
That was the one I did in Morocco called Pan Africa Rally.
Mm.
Pan Africa, I think, ran two or three editions.
Mm.
And it was essentially an amateur rally,
mm.
which is what I was at the point of time. That was 2018. But that rally really opened my eyes. Like, even though it was an amateur rally, I was not prepared for the... I did manage to finish the rally, no doubt. But I very quickly realized that... like, whatever you do here, stages are short, you know.
Mm.
Desert Storm runs, I think the longest stage run so far is a 200 kilometer stage. Mm. Mm. 200 kilometers is a shortest stage in international rally. So Pan Africa was a good eye opener for me.
So let's talk about preparation. Let's talk about physical preparation first. What did it take for you to get to the level that you are at right now? And are you in peak fitness level, or do you still need to move further on?
So I would, okay, let me answer it this way. In 2021 Dakar, which was, you know, just the year after COVID, and peak COVID, 2020 was the preparation year. I didn't get a lot of time in 2020 because I was stuck on the ship for like 7 months because of COVID. And eventually I managed to travel to Europe, and I could put in, I was fit, but I wasn't where I wanted to be or should have been. And it also kind of opened my eyes to what has to change, which I've been working over the past 2 years. So this...
Like, what has to change?
So what I see now, and in okay, also in the last year, I have also done a few courses for, you know, like program design, physical training, nutrition. It's I have basically taken a step back and then tried to figure out like what top athletes do. And if you don't have factory support and if you don't have, you know, like a whole team, you know, not a performance center behind you, let's say, how can you very closely then replicate? So I have spent time doing like, you know, online courses, nutrition courses. That was the first step for me to really understand how do you design a program which can run for a year or even 2 years. How to have modules of what you want to do in the first quarter of the year, the second quarter of the year. And that has that is what has essentially changed programming. And now I feel a lot more confident in how I have trained myself and the fitness level I'm at. I could have done more. I think that that will always be the case.
But are you happy with where you are right now?
I am happy with where I am. I would say I'm confident in where I am and the time that I have put in. Happy is a term that I very rarely use because I don't think I'm ever happy. You know, I still want to I want to do more.
You want to push your limits.
Yeah.
Just for our reference, to understand where your physical fitness level is, everybody understands the effort that it takes to put in 10 push-ups. How many push-ups can you do in one go?
To be honest, I have never.
So just give us like.
But I would say, again, see, there's not a lot of difference between a guy who's fit and goes to the gym and an athlete. In if you compare, let's say, push-ups, you know.
So what would be a good comparison?
Depends on the sport. I would say depends on the sport. Ours is an endurance sport. So what we need is endurance. So I have had people come train with me. You know, best physical shape to look at. Someone who's like chiseled six-pack, but can't swing their leg without tilting the motorcycle towards themselves. So there's no hip mobility, for instance. You know, so fitness is very subjective. Fitness means a lot of whole lot of different things to different people. For the sport, endurance sport, it's an endurance sport, but it's also high contact sport. So rally racing, or in general off-roading, but more so rally racing, is so niche. You need the fitness and endurance of, let's say, a triathlete.
Okay.
Right? Because you need to go on for that many hours. But at the same time, you also need strength of a power lifter, because you need to muscle that big bike around. Right? So there are so many aspects to rally racing. So you have to ask the right questions, like what are you training for, and when are you training for what? Endurance can't be trained with short bursts of let's say half an hour or 1 hour periods. Endurance is a volume game, and most people, like what we see on Instagram, you know, people really gung-ho, athletes really gung-ho, you know, pushing things and sweating and really cycling fast and, you know, running sprints. That's not how endurance is trained. That's also not how they train endurance. I mean, it looks good on social media, of course. Nobody wants to see me, you know, walk on a 4-degree incline for 2 hours. But that's what it takes, right? To build endurance, really good endurance, you need to put in volume. 3 hours of, you know, just one steady heartbeat, 135 beats per minute, but that looks boring. No one wants to see that.
Do you also train yourself mentally?
I do. That actually is the most challenging part. I get distracted very easily. So, and now, especially with, you know, the phones in front of you all the time, that's probably true for everybody. So I do have a training regime where I use apps. Basically, these are cognitive function apps, and they force you to bring, you know, concentration for short bursts, but really true focus for short bursts of periods.
And the third part is riding the motorcycle and upping your skill levels on that motorcycle. What have you been doing over there? Do you have like a coach who teaches you?
I don't have a coach here. In fact, I am training people now in the last year and a half. But what I have done over the last 2 years is I have started riding with really young riders,
mm-hmm.
you know, who are in their peak fitness, national champions. I've trained a lot over the last year and a half with Rugved,
okay.
who just clinched Barguje just clinched his national championship yesterday.
Mm.
And I think for me that has been the best training, because I of course put in a lot of hours which is required for rally racing,
mm.
and that I do by myself. But if I have to push myself, it's best to get, you know, all the young guys on your track, or you go visit their track,
mm.
and it's also a good reality check for them. You know, if a 42-year-old guy and you struggle to keep up with a 42-year-old, then I think mm. There's also something to be said about that. So they push themselves as well,
mm.
and that's always really interesting.
Forgive me for asking this question, but why aren't you with the factory team?
I think I still need to up my skills a lot to be at that level. B, the risk appetite, and I would also say to a certain level, the age that I entered the sport
mm.
in. I started racing just 5-6 years back
mm.
at 36.
When you were 36. Mm.
Yes. So I think there are those hurdles where, you know, it's a bit too late probably.
Okay. So let's talk about your first Dakar. What were your expectations and what was the reality once you went and took part?
So I went in Malemoto, which again is a much tougher proposition than mm. going with a service team. As I said, I spoke to a lot of people who raced the Dakar, but nothing prepares you for the reality until mm. you have done like a couple of stages. And I would say just the first stage, you know. It really, really opened my eyes on what was in store for us for the next 12 days. And I wouldn't say it was very far from reality, but what I realized was that because I was in Malemoto, I also didn't have enough time to recover every day.
Mm.
And one of the things I realized was also that I prioritized the bike maintenance before my recovery, but then that kind of started working against me after 4 to 5 days because the stacking effect is so much, right?
Mm.
And eventually after I came back, I think with rally racing, the key aspect remains recovery. If you are recovered for the next day, the lesser stacking effect you have of fatigue, that really truly is the key. So apart from that incident that I had where I had to be airlifted, I think for my first Dakar, I was not caught out anywhere where, you know, I had to spend like really ridiculously long hours in the desert or made any navigation errors. I was still making good time to come back to the bivouac normally by 3:34 p.m.
mm-hmm.
which is for a first outing, I think, is a pretty reasonable time.
Just for clarity for our viewers and listeners, what is Malemoto?
Yeah, so Malemoto is where you have no assistance. So you race your motorcycle, you come back to the bivouac, and then you have to fix your motorcycle yourself. You're not allowed any outside assistance. If there's something broken on the motorcycle that you don't know how to fix, technicians are allowed to tell you what to do, but not touch the motorcycle. Only competitors within that group or category are allowed to help each other physically with tools or touching the motorcycles. You don't have the luxury of camper vans or, you know, trucks where you could have a lie flat bed, for instance. You have to pitch your own tent. You have to fold that tent in the morning. Essentially, you're a one-man army.
And you have one trunk where everything has to fit in.
Yes. So the organization will transport one kit bag for you. Three sets of tires, one set of wheels, and that's about it. Yeah, and then that trunk, mm. which has all your spare parts and everything. Mm.
Are you a trained mechanic?
I'm an engineer, so I always had that advantage, mm. and I have always been working on motorcycles. Although I'm a marine engineer, I still have forever been working on motorcycles, so that has been an advantage. Yes, it's easy for me to look at a manual and then work on a motorcycle. So even if it was something that I hadn't trained for, or, you know, I hadn't opened up, I could very easily just look at a manual on the phone and I could work on the motorcycle.
Was opting for Malimoto a factor of your confidence or your budgets?
A little bit of both, but I think the deciding factor was the difficulty level. So I like to do difficult things. And although this year I'm not in the Malimoto category, I want to return to that category. Because I finished that rally in the experience category, which, because I missed a couple of stages. So I still want to go back and finish the Dakar rally in the Malimoto category. So that is still the goal.
And you were airlifted. What happened?
It was a crash I had. I don't remember exactly how the crash happened, but I had some head trauma. And I spent 48 hours in the hospital running a lot of scans, and eventually I was allowed to join back. But I don't remember much of the crash, and I guess that's how, you know, concussions work.
Yeah. I have to ask you about family support, because that's a very essential part of being able to do what you do. How does that work behind the scenes for you?
So for my mom and dad, it's been an uphill journey accepting what I'm doing, you know, coming from a marine engineering background and having that sort of a job for years, and then, you know, suddenly a switch to something so dangerous. So that's, of course, it's taken some getting used to, let's say. But otherwise, you know, from home, the support has always been there. Eventually, I personally feel that the risk in rallying is probably lower than riding a two-wheeler on the streets of Pune. So again, like I said, with rallying as a form of racing, the risk is still held in your hands, right? If you are not up to it, or, you know, you just aren't feeling the motorcycle for, let's say, the first 30-40 kilometers, you still can pull back a little, you know, pull back a little 10% until you get that flow again, and then you push again. And which is not the case with track racing, right? You need to be on it. And the rallies are, again, the stages are so long. So you do have time to kind of pull back and then, you know, go really push. You can figure out what are your strong suits. Like, are you fast in the dunes? Are you fast on the sandy tracks? You know, you can pace yourself that way.
What do you prefer? Sand tracks, mountain roads? Obviously, now that Dakar doesn't really have mountain roads. South America had those. It does? Yeah.
So, Saudi has really varied terrain. And especially this year, from what it looks like, it's starting in Alula, which is the northwestern part of Saudi. I think the first 3 to 4 days are going to be really, really rocky. So, okay, they do have mountains, but they are like rocky and pebbles passes.
Okay.
That come down into sandy tracks, and but they are so tough to ride. So the sand tracks and the dunes are so much easier. And it looks like the dunes are really difficult to ride, and I used to kind of struggle with them initially. But once you get the flow in the dunes, they are actually the easier part of the rally.
So the harder part are the mountain passes?
The mountain passes, yeah, the rocky sections, riverbeds. And essentially, once, if the riverbeds and these rocky sections are towards the end of the stage and the cars have passed you by then the riding becomes even more difficult, because the cars and the trucks, they rut up, they pull, the stones that are embedded into the ground, right? Those are pulled out. So everything's loose. So that actually is the more tricky part.
Is there something about the Dakar that terrifies you, that gives you nightmares?
No, not really. I think that I used to have that feeling initially when I started rallying, and like the previous rallies that I did out in Morocco or even Africa Eco, when I didn't have much experience behind me. So there's always that thing about the unknown, and that's what rally racing is, right? You get that road book like 15 minutes before the start. So you really don't know what's coming and how tough it's going to be. But eventually, now as my riding confidence has increased, that is not something that I think about anymore.
A lot of riders say that they are not worried about, but they struggle with navigation. Has that also been an issue with you?
Not so much. Because I have a marine background, and although I am not a navigating officer, I am an engineer. There's always, you know, things that you pick up, and the most confusing part has for most people is always the compass heading. And as a marine engineer, the compass heading is something like the most basic thing that you already know. So I've been fairly, let's say, good at navigating right from the beginning. And if you are anywhere between 30 to 60, right, in the order, then the navigation is more about verification.
Okay, which track to take?
Because there will be wrong tracks as well.
Yeah.
So there is a little bit less cognitive demand in terms of, for instance, the top 10 guys who are actually opening the track. Here, you have multiple clues. And if you understand headings, that is the easiest form of navigating. Once you understand headings, because even if you take a wrong track and the heading doesn't match, you know that it doesn't match, and you need to take corrective action. And you need to make sure then that, okay, either you read it wrong or you are on the wrong track. But as long as you understand headings, I think it's then fairly easy.
And then you can just focus on your riding.
Yes.
So in terms of your riding, what's the one area that you need to still work on?
I think I would still say getting faster in the dunes. Now I like riding in the dunes. But again, the risk level in the dunes is quite high, because these are like, we're talking like really big dunes, you know, sometimes 800, 900 meter climbs. And with the dunes, it's like a fine dance, you know, because you need a lot of speed to get to the top of the dune, but you need to shed all that speed to cut that dune and then start rolling on the other side. And you don't know what's on the other side. So I think the guys who are really good at riding dunes are really good at actually reading the dunes. And they can predict what's on the other side 9 out of 10 times. And that one time where they go wrong, they have the confidence to actually not crash and then, you know, basically correct their mistake. And I think that is something that I would love to work on. The challenge always remains how much seat time you get in practice. It's really difficult to go and find those kind of dunes anywhere in India or in Dubai. Dubai has dunes, but not these size dunes. For this, you need to go to Abu Dhabi, where the Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge takes place. The Liwa area has fantastic places to really practice this. But again, if you want to rent a bike there in Dubai, a rally bike, for instance, costs like 50,000 rupees a day.
So in terms of seat time, how much seat time have you put in this year for the 24 Dakar?
I've put in a lot of seat time. I'm on the bike pretty much 4 days a week, but that's on my track. So the seat time's there, but I need a lot more seat time in sand and on a rally bike. And that always comes in limited hours. So I am heading to Dubai for my final training, like I said. But again, you know, 4 days, that's essentially to just get the feeling back of riding dunes and riding sands on the big bike and nothing more. To be able to really push yourself and get faster in the dunes, get better at reading, that should have been done in the first half of this year. So I got in a lot of seat time in terms of actually racing the Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge, because Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge, 5 days, you just stay in dunes. Like it's 250 to 300 kilometers every day of just dunes, because there is no terrain variation. So that was really good. It boosted my confidence a lot. But having said that, I would still like maybe, you know, another month with a rally bike in the dunes, and that would be ideal.
So let's talk about your bike and your prep for this year. You were telling me that you've got a new bike for this year?
Yes, it's a KTM Rally Replica. So I had a 2019 KTM Rally Replica, which I sold after the Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge. And now I've invested in a brand new motorcycle, which I haven't seen yet. The bike was bought and delivered to the race team in Spain. They prepped the motorcycle and it's already passed scrutiny in Barcelona and right now is on a ship to Saudi.
So that's your motorcycle. In terms of the team that you're participating with, who are they?
Yes, so I'm racing this year with X-Raids Experience. They are a team based out of Spain. And Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge was also the race that I did with them.
How many bikes do they run?
This year at the Dakar, they are running 9 motorcycles. So 9 riders. And they are quite a big team, been in the business for very long. And Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge also, we had excellent support from them. So yeah, we are looking forward to this.
Do they also help you in terms of motorcycle setup, in giving you tips on what to do in the stages to get better times?
No, not really. The teams don't work that way as such. I think only the factory teams basically have that kind of infrastructure around them with people dedicated to every, you know, small thing. Essentially, with teams that cater to privateers, it's more about setup, yes, of course. The suspension setup and all that is done before the bike's loaded, of course, you know, the spring rates, everything have been calculated. So now when we have 2 days of testing, they will help us basically fine-tune that. What generally the team does is we discuss like whatever comes out of briefing and it's like a shared... let's say a brainstorming session that happens, you know, when we sit for dinner or and what the profile looks like. But essentially the mechanics are the key to any of these teams that help the privateers, because there is a lot to do on the motorcycles in the evening. And especially if you crash and wreck things, then they're really on a timeline to, you know, fix it by the next morning. So the bigger focus for these teams is to make sure that, you know, everything for you is catered to. And secondly, that, or more importantly, that the bike is in a good shape for you to ride the next day.
Are you going to be sleeping in a tent in the bivouac or do you have a motorhome?
No, I have upgraded. I have paid for upgrade, let's say. So I'm going to be staying in a truck that can sleep about 6 to 8 people.
Okay.
The next upgrade would have been a camper van just for two. But at the moment, this is the upgrade that I have opted for.
And obviously, it is much more comfortable than sleeping in your own tent and pitching your own tent.
Yes, I think, pitching the tent is the key. and more so when it's cold and then, you know, wrapping up the tent in the morning, that's a pain in the ass for sure. It's so cold in Saudi once the sun goes down. And mornings are like 2-3 degrees and it's biting cold. So doing anything around a tent is so difficult.
Another important aspect of prep is sponsors. Who do you have as sponsors this year? And what support are you getting?
So we have signed up a lot of people this year. Essentially, Rhinox and Rise Moto have been working with me for the long term. Slipstream Performance has also been working with me since, like, even before the last Dakar. They have been phenomenally helpful. And then there are a lot of other brands that have come on board. Moto Usher, Lazy Ass Bikers, Big Bad Bikes, who are our homegrown brands here. They have also been supporting me for years again. Not just for the Dakar, but because I have dirt bikes here and the parts aren't available. Between these three, we have sorted out kind of an ecosystem that keeps, you know, the whole thing running. And then we also have sponsors that have come on board exclusively for the Dakar. There's Wanderlooms, there's Bay City that has come on board. There's a Dubai-based company, 11777, who are a marketing company who has come on board. So yeah, it's been a process. There are long-term partners and then there are short-term partners who have just shown interest around the Dakar.
How much does it cost to run a Dakar? Let's start with the entry fee.
So the total number is going to come to 1 CR. That includes your qualifying round.
Okay.
Right. So ballpark figures, Your qualifying round is going to cost you around 20 lakh rupees.
Mm.
Anywhere you go. You could go to Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge. You could go to Rally du Maroc. Then your entry fees are roughly 16 lakh rupees.
Mm.
Your service is going to cost you around 18 to 20 lakh rupees, depending on the options you take, you know, where you want to sleep and things that you want to put on the motorcycle. The motorcycle itself, you could rent. You could rent it for 15 to 18 lakh rupees, or you could choose to buy one, which will cost you 30 lakh rupees. So it all kind of, these are the big numbers. And then the small bits also add up. There's gear you have to invest in. This year, the rules for airbag vests have changed. So until Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge earlier this year, you could have an airbag vest that had one cartridge, that is one deployment. Now it's compulsory to have a double deployment airbag. So an airbag costs 60,000-70,000 rupees. I can't use the two I have at home now. So I had to buy more. They need six cartridges as spare to be presented at scrutiny. Each cartridge costs 11,000-12,000 rupees. So all these small things add up. An FIM license, which I'm supposed to get today, costs 50,000 rupees.
Okay.
You know, so there are all these smaller bits, then that they start adding up. So eventually, I think you need to account for a 1 crore cost for the campaign.
Okay. And the first Dakar that you did, going back, that was bootstrapped, that you did all on your own.
Yeah, I would say 90% of it was my own. I got help from these brands that I mentioned earlier for the other 10%, which I think was still fair enough because I hadn't proved myself back then. This year, it's much more like 70-80% have come from brands. And then I still have...
How difficult is it to get sponsors now? Or is it becoming better now that the interest in the Dakar is there, the visibility in the Dakar is there? We also have an Indian brand, two Indian brands actually in the Dakar. We also have Harith in the Dakar. Yes. So awareness has gone up?
Awareness has gone up. I think, of course, if I look back at 2020 and then now 3 years later, there's much more awareness. And also, I think Indian brands have taken a keen interest in proving their products at the rally, because they have, like, for instance, Rhinox, we unveiled our kit at IBW, and we are so happy to see that for the first time an Indian athlete is wearing Indian gear. You know, so that is a humongous step, and this is what is needed, because the sport is so niche. And it's good to see that more and more players are coming in. Rise Moto is another example. They are a tire company based out of Gujarat. And I signed with them earlier this year. And eventually the aim remains to one day, you know, race the Indian tires there. So there is interest. And at the same time, it's not easy. I would say it's not easy. Definitely, I think you need to build a brand where people can trust you, and more importantly, I think brands have to trust that you will follow through on
what you have committed to.
Yeah. I think that is that remains the big gap for most brands.
What is your target for the 24 Dakar?
Finish. That's always the target. I don't have a number set in mind. With rallies that are this long, things keep moving up and down every single day. The aim would be to finish clean. And by clean, I mean no navigation penalties, no injuries. You know, you're going to have a few tumbles here and there. It's the Dakar. But stay consistent and finish clean. The numbers take care of themselves by the end of 14 days.
Yeah. In terms of tumbles, in a normal stage on the Dakar, how many times on average would you fall?
No, sometimes never.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes you have maybe one or two. Again, it depends. The game is recovery. It's about fatigue. Sometimes you crash at a place where you know you're better than that. You know, it's just that the fatigue has taken over. You've ridden for like 480 kilometers, and then with 20 kilometers to go, you know, you make a stupid mistake. It's just because you're fatigued. So sometimes, you have a really clean stage. Sometimes the stage is easy and yet you just keep tumbling, you know, for no reason, and it's sometimes just fatigue. You don't have that flow state.
All this is the Dakar. Now, to get to the Dakar, you need to have a day job. What is your day job?
I used to be a marine engineer until last May. Well, I still am a marine engineer. I'm just not actively sailing anymore. I have now started training people. So the last year and a half, I've been training athletes as well as adventure riders. Mm. So I founded Off-Piste Racing in 21, November of 21. And I went sailing after that for like half a year. But then when I got back in May 22, I've been solely focusing on training. So
your day job, your hobby, everything is bikes. You live, right, eat, breathe bikes.
Right now, yeah, it does revolve around two wheels, yes.
Yeah, and obviously you're having a blast with it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the dream job, right? And sometimes it's said that it's better sometimes not to turn your passion into work, because then you sometimes, you know, start to lose that passion. But I think with this, I don't think that will be the case for me.
Yeah. Looking forward, and since you're training riders also, do you see more riding talent coming out of India going and taking part in the Dakar? Or is it a step too far?
Talent, there's a lot of talent. But I also keep telling people I train, the athletes, that, you know, talent is as cheap as table salt. It's, you know, it's like one small portion of the equation. There's so many things that an athlete needs to work on, not just talent. And I think that evolvement is still not there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the motorsport scenario in India right now, the racing that we have,
mm-hmm.
Is so limited, and I would dare say it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
If you take rallies, for instance, the stages are like 20 kilometers. And it's because it's difficult to design stages that are longer. Like, you know, there are so many hurdles for organizers to create like a 200 kilometer stage.
Yeah, we got population, right?
Exactly.
That's the main problem,
so,
right?
So the only place to go then is like you need to go to Rajasthan, for instance, where you can create those kind of stages. And then the big brands need to be involved in motorsport to help the organizers create that kind of events. So all this added up kind of limits the exposure that Indian athletes have. Because now, okay, you want to go international, but then the step is from 20 kilometers to maybe go do a Baja, which is going to be 200 kilometers. So that gap is so huge. Right? Because the easiest thing you can do in cross country is Bajas. Two-day rally. But then Baja is 200 kilometers a day. So jumping from 20 to 200 is a big leap. And that gap kind of needs to be filled. So I am, like, people who are training with me now, I have kind of started getting them slowly to go with me. Like, one guy is now joining me to go to Dubai.
Okay.
With me. So it's just the first exposure of, you know, what is the terrain out there, and can you go then and just, you know, I'm not doing a lot of training because I'm there to train myself. But it's like, you know, you just wet your feet. You go and, okay, I'm going to ride for 4 hours in the dunes. Like, you know, how many hours and what does it feel like just to be out there for 4 hours? And those steps have to be taken slowly. And I think planning is extremely important. And to be able to do anything like that, the off-bike training has to be planned as well. It needs to be programmed. This is what is missing and is the biggest factor that's missing in what I see with young
athletes. So off-bike training as in terms of your nutrition, your diet, your physical fitness?
Physical fitness, nutrition, sleep, most important. People kind of tend to forget that the lowest hanging fruit, you know, sleep. Designing a program, what's your A race? So if I take my example, Dakar is my A race, And then whatever else I do through the year are all B races.
Mm.
So everything has to be designed around the A race.
Mm.
The B races are just, you know, you have to go and race because you need to stay current. Mm.
So you peak for your A race.
Yes. That has to be designed around the A race. So I think this approach is still lacking.
Mm.
There are very few athletes, like I would say the factory riders that we have had, Santosh, KP, Noha, who are working at this level. Again, they have had the support of factory teams who can probably, more than the teams, I would say they have had the support of their teammates.
Mm.
Because there's so much you can learn from your teammates who have so much experience, right?
Mm.
So when we step into a team, and if there's a guy who's done like 5-6 Dakars, there's so much to learn from him.
Mm.
So I think, in terms of all this off-bike training, that's a huge gap to fill for us.
All right. And if you have one recommendation for some young kid who's listening or watching this podcast, who has dreams of the Dakar eventually, what's that one piece of advice that you would give him or her?
I would say get a coach and listen to him.
Mm.
Because more than often we think that we have the answers, or because there's, let's say, the family's been into racing and, you know, there's some kind of experience there. But a coach works very differently.
Mm.
So I think I would say staying consistent and having a coach for the long term is probably one huge favor that they can do themselves.
All right. Thank you, Ashish. Thank you for your time, and wish you the very best for the Dakar. When are you heading off to Saudi?
I'll head out on the 31st of December.
All right. So 31st, you head out to Saudi, and then 5th, the rally starts.
Yes. From 1st to 4th, we have time to test and get everything ready. And 5th is the prologue. Yes.
All the best, Ashish. Stay safe and fly the flag proudly for the country.
Most definitely. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. And thank you guys for listening and watching to the podcast. Do follow Ashish. Do follow his progress on social media. Ashish actually has got a pretty strong social media game now. So you obviously will be posting what's happening daily on the Dakar. So follow him. Give him a shout out on social media. And of course, if you have any more questions for Ashish, drop it in the comments and we will get back to you. Thank you guys for watching. And if you have recommendations on whom we should talk to on our next podcast, do let us know also in the comments. Thank you once again.